This is Where Did the Road Go? Our aim is to explore the fringe, to be true skeptics and question openly, to investigate the paranormal, bring light to the dark corners of history, and give a voice to the shunned of science. We deal in mystery and the important questions that these subjects bring to light. What is reality? Who are we? And why are we here? Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com for a full show archive, links to all our social media, upcoming schedule, and much, much more. Now, join your host Soraya on this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
Welcome to this edition of Where Did the Road Go? And tonight we're going to be airing part two of my talk with Jeff Ritzman. And just a note, if you're listening to this live, myself, Michael Hughes, and Joshua Cutchin will be at Fort Fest down in Hanover, Maryland tomorrow, Sunday. If you're not listening to this live, maybe we'll have some stuff to put up from it later in the week. And if you want to hear this whole interview with Jeff from beginning to end, you can become a patron for $3 a month, and that whole interview is up there in one piece. Yeah, and I'm going to have an extra bit from him as well soon. All right, so without any further ado, here is part two of my talk, out of three, with Jeff Ritzman. All right, we're back with Jeff Ritzman, and I guess now we should get into some of the weird things that happened later in life to you. I did have one question about your earlier life. I remember you on Project Archivist saying something that you did have a counselor who had, like when you explained your experiences to her, she actually had similar ones.
That was in elementary school. And that was a really brief period there where, I've rambled on so much, I've completely lost my voice. sorry, audience, for that. I had a guidance counselor at the elementary school who was an older lady, and when she retired, I was probably in fourth or fifth grade, and we got a younger lady, and I was sent to see her about sleep, and when I explained to her what it was about, she got to talking to me about art class and how I really showed a lot of aptitude for that. And, and what was I doing? Were my parents doing anything to foster? I said, oh yes, they're sending me to classes on the weekends and this, that, and the other. And she said, do you like it? I said, I love it. And she says, okay, now let's get to why you're not sleeping at night and what's going on. And I just said, you know what? It's safe here. She seems really nice. Just going to spill it. And I spilled it. And I told her what happened. And she got she looked at me very intensely. And I thought, oh, I'm in trouble. Like, I got the feeling like I was going to get in trouble. And I felt like I was going to get in trouble. And this is an interesting thing about experiencers, is that when they get together in a group and they talk about these things very openly with other experiencers, that's the feeling that they walk away from or walk away with, is that they feel like they've told a secret they shouldn't tell, like they're not supposed to be talking about this. This is a very common thing. The guidance counselor said, well, I said, I know nobody believes me when I say this. They all think I'm dreaming, and I know I'm not dreaming. And she said, well, I don't think you're dreaming either. And she said, I've had things very similar to what you describe. And I said, you do? What is it? What does it mean? And she's like, I have no idea. But, you know, and she told me basically what a counselor that I saw in my 30s, I think, told me. He said the same thing, is there are things that we just can't explain about human experience. And I think he described it best. He said, you know, there are people who really have peak human experience, and that's what this is. There is no explaining it. And, you know, he said, you're welcome to investigate it, but it can be extremely toxic and it can lead to obsession. And it can. Which is, you know, which is another way that it manifests itself. You know, the more attention you pay, the more you poke it, you know, blank doesn't stink till you stir it. That's the kind of, that's kind of the modus operandi of a little bit in a way of this stuff, if that makes any sense. That's just kind of how it seems to play out. And then again, that falls all within the marginality, the anti-structure and all that. It's easily dismissible. You know, for the believer, there's no more proof that's needed. For the skeptic, it's easily dismissed. So this is just the way it works. So you got to work within that.
Now, you had a very weird experience in your teens where you lost, I wouldn't say you lost time, you lost distance, sort of.
Yeah, gained distance, yeah. Yeah. Lost a lot of respect from my family members about knowing how to drive and being trusted with a car. Yeah, I mean, the long and short of it was, you know, I live in Maryland, so we have Ocean City, Maryland. And having the car, I wanted to drive my car down, and we went down pretty frequently. I mean, I went down without issue, had a great time. My parents drove their car, I drove mine, so I could tool around Ocean City as much as I wanted. And on the way home, for non-Marylanders, which I assume is a lot of you, you know, you have to go over a couple of bridges, the Francis Scott Key Bridge and the Chesapeake Bay Bridge. So the Chesapeake Bay Bridge on the way home is the first bridge that you encounter, the first big one. And we were just about to it. And that usually meant you were most of the way home. And I lost sight of where my dad was. I did not know how to drive there. I had to follow him. And dad is a chronic lane changer. Like, he's not satisfied with a lane. He has to be in, like, first position. Right? So my dad's an old stock car driver. So he always wants to be in first. So, you know, I was beside of him, and a tractor trailer went between us, and I kept an eye. But when the tractor trailer had gone by us, I looked, and he was getting off on an exit. So I panicked. I got off on the next exit and wound up going down the street. All of this happens within no more than 20 to 25 minutes to maybe a half an hour in totality, to where I end up at the end of this, which, you know, I find a store at the end of the street, and there's a guy there. His car is broken down. Again, his car looks odd, but I couldn't describe it to you. He had a Cleveland Browns shirt on. I went over to the payphone. That's how he got to talk, and I went over to the payphone. He goes, "Payphone doesn't work." I said, "Oh, okay." I said, "Well, the convenience store is closed. Looks like it's been closed." I said, "Which way is the Bay Bridge from here? Is it to my left? Is it down this way?" "Yeah, straight up that road. Go a little bit, blah, blah, blah." I said, "Great." He said, "Hey, I hate to ask you this, but I'm broke down here. Could you maybe drive me up the street? My house is literally like 2 minutes up the street." I said, "Yeah, sure." Which I had never picked up a hitchhiker before, but he looked okay to me, as they say. And, you know, he got in, and at the time I had a 1974 Torino GT, and it was ridiculously fast. And we're going down the road, and, you know, I think there may have been a couple of small talk about the car, and it began to get a little dark. It was getting dark when I stopped. I mean, again, this is all within a very short period of time. And I get to kind of a dark spot on the road where it's a two-lane road, and I see it, I don't know, like a stone driveway going back into the woods. And he says, "What? This is me." I said, "Okay." I said, "If you don't mind, I'm going to drop you off here," because I'm thinking, I'm not going back there with him. I don't know who this guy is, and I don't like the look of that, right? So it's probably fine, but I'm letting him off here. So about that time, you've got that twilighty look about things. It's just enough darkness to get confused about, you know, signs on the road and all that. And so I flipped the lights on, and he's not getting out, and I'm kind of like I don't know, looking out the front, and I'm going, so it's straight up here? As I just keep going straight? He's like, yeah, yeah, just keep going straight. And I look over at him, and again, this is where it falls apart for most people. This man looked nothing like the man who got in the car with me. Nothing. This was not a trick of light and shadow. His skin was abnormally smooth, and it was just not the same man. It didn't resemble him. The clothes did. The clothes were the same. The face was different. And it was startling. And I just found myself, when I looked at him, I kind of looked at a quarter of my eye, and then when I finally turned my head completely to look at him, I just kind of froze. And I didn't know what to say, and I kind of mumbled something that I don't remember. And he opened the door, and the light, the dome light came on in the ceiling. And he said, it's good. He said something akin to, you're okay. It's going to be okay. And I said, okay. And he said, I'll see you again. And I said, okay. I didn't ask, what does that mean? I just said, okay. Okay. And he got out of the car and shut the door. Man, I'm telling you what, that 351 Cleveland never tore so fast away from somebody. I put it to the floor, and I'm kind of looking back like, is he chasing me? Like, I don't know what's going on. This is just very strange and just really unsettling. So I drive literally what seemed about 3 miles up the road, and I come to a cross street that looks a hell of a lot like a place called Route 40 in Maryland. A lot of businesses, a lot of truck stops and whatnot. It's a truck stop right there on the corner. I pull in, I go in, I tell him I'm lost. I don't know where I am. Where's the Bay Bridge? How do I get the Bay Bridge from here? And the waitress at the counter goes, Bay Bridge. I'm not, where do you, I said, Chesapeake Bay Bridge, the Bay Bridge to go to Baltimore. One of the truck drivers down the end on the, like in the little booth says, boy, you are lost, ain't you? I'll never forget that guy's voice. And I was like, I guess so. And he, you know, comes over and unfolds a map and he says, you're right here. And I was in the southern tip of Ohio. Now that logistically is impossible.
Right.
I didn't have enough gas for that. I hadn't driven that long. You know, it's like, no, this is not getting lost. This is serious now because how am I getting home? So I began blubbering like a fool and crying. They called, you know, the police came.
How old were you at the time?
I think I was 17.
Okay.
Pretty sure I was.
Well, that's a pretty reasonable response considering your situation.
Yeah, I mean, I guess. A little embarrassing. I mean, I was genuinely embarrassed when I walked out of the place. I just said, I don't know how I'm even getting home. And I tried calling to the house. I did have enough change and some money in my pocket from the weekend that I could make some phone calls and try to get, you know, I called my, you know, my mom and dad, couldn't get them, called the neighbors across the street who were very close to us and couldn't get them. And I don't know what I'm going to do. And, I'm reasonably sure, and I can't remember anymore. Again, I'm almost 50 now. I'm pretty sure they told me it was close to 6 hours to get home.
Wow.
And I said, I don't even know how to get home. How am I going to get home? You know, I said, I don't have gas for this, you know? So.
And this is not modern day where you can also just plug it into a GPS.
No, there was no, I didn't even have a cell phone then. I mean, there was no cell phones for,
right.
I mean, you know, that was for the Uber millionaires, you know, but it ended up that the waitress then came out and she felt really sorry for me. She was super sweet. And she gave me this, money and a bag of food. And she said, you know, they all collected this for you and they really feel bad. And this man is, he's going to, DC and he's going right by where you should be able to know where you're at. So you can just follow him and he'll take you all the way practically home. And I said, okay. And, and the state cop said, you know, is there anything else you need? I said, no, I mean, they collected well over $100 for me.
Nice.
And I thought that was, I mean, that again, just made me completely turn into a puddle. And so I filled the car up with gas and then that tractor trailer was waiting beside that street for me. And down we went and, you know, never passed that convenience store. Never saw it wasn't there. And I walked in the door about very close to, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 o'clock in the morning. And I'm thinking, man, am I going to get it? I mean, I'm not going to be able to sit down for a week, because the whole time I'm going, I'm like, I can't lose this truck driver, because if I lose him, I don't know where I'm going. And I have a map, but can I figure it out to know where to go? And it ended up, I did lose him somewhere towards the end of the trip, but he got me most of the way home.
Right.
And I just thought, I can't stop to call, because if I stop to call, and they're out looking, I mean, God, they've probably contacted police. They're out looking. I rolled in the driveway. My dad's truck was in the driveway. And I went in the house and tried to set my keys down quietly. And I was so tired. I mean, I was so tired. It was ridiculous. And my dad comes walking out in his underwear and T-shirt out of the back room. And he says, where you been? I said, Dad, you're not going to believe how lost I got. I tried to tell him the entire story about what had happened. And he was completely nonplussed about it. He said, all right, well, get in there and get to bed. It's whatever o'clock in the morning. Get to bed. You're going to wake up your mother. That was it. That was it. Nothing? Really? Nothing? This is not my father. I don't know who this is, but this is not my father. No, it was my dad. But, I mean, again, just like Mom with It's a Weather Balloon, it was kind of this, kind of like, you weren't out looking. Why were you not out looking for me?
Right.
I mean, it just made no sense. And I remember telling my papa, my mom's dad, I said, Pop, he wasn't even out looking for me. And he's like, well, I can't explain that either, because if I'd have known that you weren't home, I would have been out looking for you. And I was like, right. So he's like, I don't know. It's very strange. And I was like, well, it is very strange. And, but Pop believed where I was. And I'm telling you, I've moved since then. I moved, I moved out of my house to an apartment. And I moved from there to a condo, and I moved from there to my house that I'm living in now. Somewhere in this menage of stuff, I've got the pack of matches I took from the counter of that place. And I just need to find it. That's the marginal part of the story. I have the match packs. Not that that means anything. It would only mean something to me, but I would love to know what the name of that place was. And
right. To know exactly where you were.
Yeah. But that kind of thing, like that never, it was that one time. It never happened again. But you talk about displacement. Cripe. I mean,
yeah.
That was one of the more, like serious fear of being in trouble, or serious fear of like, when I get home, there's going to have to be police there, because they're going to have to be looking for me. Like, really, nobody was looking for me. Nobody was looking for me.
they got home, you weren't there, and they just went to bed.
Apparently. You know, and apparently Dad was like, you know, well, maybe we don't need this kid. He's the only one we got, but maybe we need to rethink this, you know. If he's gone, he's gone. What are you going to do, Judy, you know? But, that was really very bizarre. I mean, I to this day, I mean, again, that's something I've remembered all these years, and I never made the connection for what that meant or what that was. Never heard of such a thing. Who would have ever believed that?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
They think, now you're out messing with some girl. No, I wasn't. I swear I wasn't, you know? But it wasn't until years later that you began hearing these kinds of things in, you know, on these tabloid TV shows, you know, so-and-so ended up, you know, in this place where he should have been here. And this is called this. And I don't know. It's just, slowly you turn around to the idea that something is going on in your life and it's not what other people have going on.
Right.
You know,
right.
And you're a weirdo and that's just the way you are.
Hmm. So did this stuff calm down at some point for a little bit?
Yeah. I'd say probably my college years were pretty vacant of anything. And that was an extremely anti-structural type of life at college. So there was that. And I would say right up until I was engaged to my wife. I was engaged to my wife, and I, and here's bizarre for you. I was, and I'll say this at the risk of embarrassment, because after all, look what we're talking about. How embarrassed can I be? We're all space cadets. You have to make the best of it. I was in the bathroom, taking a leak at my mom's house. My future wife was there talking to my mom in the kitchen. And as I'm finishing, I get a extreme pain in my navel. And as I look down, something comes out of my navel and hits the wall with some force, and it's blood. And the first thing that goes through your mind when this happens is, I'm coming untied. I mean, that's a bizarre thought, right? But this is what I thought. I thought, oh my God.
It's reasonable.
Oh my God. I put my hand on my stomach and I'm like, that's blood. It's blood. And it smelled. And I'm like, what is this? So, and it didn't happen like that again when I urinated, you know, in the day after that. But I went to the doctor the next day, and he takes the thing that he looks in your ear with, and he sticks it in my belly button. He's got a real long one. He sticks it in my belly button. He pushes way farther than I thought a belly button could go. and he says, this is the conversation. He says, huh. And he's looking around. I'm like, Doc, you got to put some jelly on that thing. It's killing me. And he's like, what are you into? And I said, well, what do you mean? And he says, been sticking anything down in here? I said, why in the hell would I stick anything in my belly button? I don't know. I'm just asking. I don't know what you kids are into. I said, I'm not into that. He says, well, if you could look, I'd let you look. He said, but there's 3 or 4 pin marks in here arranged in a circle at the base.
Oh.
And he said, I don't know how that had happened. And I said, well, I don't either. He said, unless you stuck something in there. And I said, I ain't stuck anything in there. He said, wish we could take a picture, because I'd love for you to see it. It's a perfect circle.
Wow.
Of 3 or 4. He said, they look like needle marks. Now, what is that? What is that? And this was the last words he said to me. And he didn't really detail it very much. He said, I don't know, Jeffrey, you get some really strange SHIT, right?
Right,
I'm like,
right.
Okay. well, there you are. I don't know what to say about that.
And it was never connected to anything?
Like, you know, I've thought about that, and not that I can really think of. I had moved into an apartment, and Lisa, my wife, and I, we had experienced some, I guess, what people would call haunting experiences. Scooby in the house where it was in an old brownstone house that I rented, and I lived in the upstairs, and 2 college girls lived in the bottom, and I would go up the stairs and into my locked door, and as we would get up the stairs and go into the door, you heard every door in the apartment close, and there were many closets, big closets in this place. You would hear every door in there closing.
Oh, wow.
And I'd look at her, and she'd look at me. She'd go, what was that? I said, I don't know. but I do remember, and I can't, again, this is why it's important, everybody out there listening, if you're having experiences, keep a journal. Date it, time it. This is crucial, because when I got out of this for years, I threw all that away because I just wanted rid of this stuff. And I threw all that stuff away. I got rid of it because I didn't want anything to do with this field anymore. But now here I am again. I'm back in it. Now I'm back in it for 10, 12 more years. And I wish I had this stuff, because then I could really tell what events coincided with what things. And,
Well, I mean, I've been keeping notes since about 1990.
Uh-huh.
And, there's times where I stopped keeping notes, and I regret that now.
Yeah.
Because my memory sucks.
Oh,
it really does. I mean,
it's worse to get older, dude. Trust me.
The stuff I remember actually pretty dead on. When I've gone through the entries, I'm like, okay, I might have had like people switched around, but the actual event was remembered right. But there's there's a few years where I'm going, I know a lot of weird stuff happened, and I am at a loss to remember any of it in any kind of detail.
Yeah.
But it's also, I found, really important, and I was told this when I started recording the stuff, to record the everyday stuff going on around it. And I was always like, mm-hmm. well, why? Or shouldn't I just be recording the weird stuff? But now I'm seeing all these weird patterns.
Right, exactly.
In the normal stuff relating to the weird stuff.
That's exactly it. And that's really, and that's one of the parts of Project Oculus that's going to be, that's something that the people who donate are going to be able to access, which is a daily log of life in this house. So it's going to be brief, but it's going to say, what happened today in the house? How was Lisa's day? How was my day? How was my son's day? We all live here. Did the dogs do anything? Did the dogs tear up the floor? Did they sleep all day? You know, what happened in the house? And then right. we keep this log. Every night I sit down for 5 minutes and I say, nothing much happened today. Had a good day at work, blah, blah, blah. That's important stuff, believe it or not. That's going to be important down the road if we get something interesting that you can look back and go, okay, that day is the day that we heard that, you know, Aunt Molly died or whatever. So that kind of stuff can be important. I couldn't tell you. I had a very weird experience at the apartment that I guess a lot of people would deem UFO related. But there was no UFO. It was more along the lines of like hearing small kids running around in places that I couldn't see in the house. But, you know, like the kitchen, you can't see the kitchen from the bedroom, but you can hear little feet, things like that. And I remember that, that particular night I was in bed, in the middle of the bed, and was covered up. I'm pretty sure that it was cold, because this place, the landlord had control of the heat, which is a bad deal, kids, if you rent an apartment. And it was really cold. And when I woke up, I woke up next to my 1975 Les Paul guitar. And I'm like, why is that in bed with me? Why is this not in its case in the living room? Why is this in bed with me? But it was. And I had no explanation for that. It was just a very strange thing to happen. I wasn't playing as I was sitting there. I went to bed. So I have no explanation for that. But it wasn't like I got up in the middle of the night. I'm a really, really light sleeper when it comes to getting up and you know, going to the bathroom. I remember that, unlike a lot of people.
Right.
I'm not one of those like sleepwalking types, you know. I mean, that's I've lived with a woman now for 25 years this year, and that's never happened. So did that coincide with the belly button? I have no idea, but it was during that period in time.
When you talked about all the doors in the apartment building slamming, yeah. Did other people notice this? I mean, was this something that you experienced?
Well, Lisa, she heard that on several occasions. We also saw somebody knocking at the door, which oddly enough, we've experienced in our house now. She experienced it last week in the bathroom. Somebody knocking on the door to the point where the door was lightly moving. It wasn't like pounding, but somebody knocked at the door and you could see the door moving slightly as the knocks happened. We saw that a number of times, her and I together, and then you'd open that door and of course nobody would be there. So we got that a number of times. There were just very odd things that more along the lines lined up with like a poltergeist type activity to me, now knowing what I know. Glasses put in weird spots in the house. Chessboard pieces moved that weren't moved before. Somewhat subtle things, but really noticeable stuff. Chest of drawers having all the handles balanced upside down. You know, like you touch them and they fall. Had that twice there. And then once in the temporary house that I lived in while our condo was being built. So there was that. Poltergeist type stuff, weird stuff. And the girls downstairs actually commented on that one time. Because I said, you know, we didn't talk very much, but I was downstairs and one of them was vacuuming the foyer. And she says, isn't this a great house? I said, it really is. I said, a little weird sometimes, though, isn't it? She just looked at me. She goes, what do you mean? I said, I don't know. We have some weird things happen. She goes, what do you mean, like ghosts? And I said, yeah. She goes, Carrie, come out here. You know? And I told them, and they just looked at each other and like went, oh, my God. And I'm like, why do you see? She's like, I'm not talking about this. That's it, you know. So obviously they'd seen something or heard something, but they didn't want to discuss it. So I didn't press it.
Right.
But yeah. And most of my experiences now that were somewhat important in my, you know, in my thought process with this stuff, most of it now, since I've been married, has happened with other people. In fact, a lot of it has happened with other people. Some friends, you know, we've lost a lot of friends over this. That, I think, is the most distressing part about it, is the way that that the phenomena can alienate you. Pardon the pun, but it's true. You will lose friends. You will spook people out. Some people will just, you know, stay away from you because they think you're nuts. But, you know,
sure.
Yeah. But that is part of how this works, too. It, you know, isolation is a big deal with this. And that's why it is important to talk about even the most bizarre aspects of it openly. Because if we keep doing that, then sooner or later, this becomes something that everybody can comfortably talk about. Yeah. So I don't mind being the whipping boy. I'm an artist. Everybody thinks I'm a weirdo anyway, so I don't really care. It is what it is, and there's nothing I can do to change it or make it more palatable for people. So that's not my job. You know, I'm just trying to make some kind of headway in this in some way before, you know, the curtain falls on us all at some point. So you got to do what you can.
And where did this progress to beyond this whole poltergeist activity?
I mean, I guess for lack of a better way to put it, Lisa and I got married, bought our first place. The condo was our first place. And strange things started to be seen there. There was a long hallway with a bathroom at one end. And Lisa and I would routinely see, and my parents, for that matter, my mom would see it routinely. House guests would see it fairly frequently. Somebody walking in and out of the bathroom. More silhouette type thing. Not really like you can describe what it looks like. It's more like a silhouette, but clearly someone coming in and out of the bathroom. We were on a second floor condominium, so it was a good, I don't know, 10, 12 feet off the ground. And Lisa saw a head go walking by out the window one day. Really freaked her out.
I'm sure.
Light phenomena in the house to some degree, but not as much as what we have now. mainly a lot of voices. And that's when I began to say to myself, okay, there's definitely something here as far as paranormal stuff goes. Like, there's ghosts here. Like, what is the history of this place? It's a new place. It's brand new.
Right.
And, you know, you find out that it's the area that used to be all mostly farmland. And then you find out that not far from where I lived is where I live now, was the original port of Baltimore. So it was very colonial-esque ship port. And so a lot of, again, very anti-structural stuff going on, a lot of liminal states going on, ships coming and going. So historically, there's a lot of liminality going on around here. But then you find out that when you talk to people like George Hansen, that, well, yeah, apartments and condominiums, people come and go. It's always in a state of transition. And so ghost activity is much more heavily reported in condominiums and apartments than they are private homes. Anybody know that? I didn't. But it's
no,
true.
I had no idea.
But it is actually true. And so, you know, when you start thinking about liminal places, an apartment is a very liminal place. It's a stopover. Most people don't live their lives in an apartment. Most people, it's a transitional place to live.
Sure.
And a condo is the same way. That's a very liminal place to live because you're going to have children. You're going to want to raise your children in a home of your own that you don't share with a bunch of other people. Plus, you've also got other people coming and leaving and having kids and moving. And so it's always in that state of flux. So all of that played in. By the way, our upstairs neighbor reported weird stuff in his condominium. Our downstairs neighbors before they moved reported weird things in the sky. There was a round patch of dead grass out front of the condo that a couple of house guests saw and said, "That's weird, right?" And I'm like, "Yeah, it's weird." you know, particularly when you hear your downstairs neighbor saying it was right over there, and then they came and they sat down right there. You know, this was a conversation we heard off the deck one day. And so, okay, I'm intrigued. Okay, because now I start to describe these experiences from my childhood to my wife, and I had described them to some detail before we were married, but then I really opened up about a lot of other strange things that I didn't really put my finger on. And and I remember, I'll never forget this. And here's where this gets extremely marginal for me, because you could easily dismiss this. We're watching a show called, I think it was Encounters or Sightings. I think it might have been Sightings. It was a little earlier for Encounters, but Sightings was on. And they were talking about a UFO case, a landed UFO in some place, and it was very interesting. And I said, you know, that's fascinating. I said, because up where my father's business is, it's extremely rural. And it's where my dad grew up, where my grandmother lived. I said, you know, we ought to go up there and just look around. So Lisa and I, we had just had our son. And he was, I don't know, he wasn't newborn, but we had been out a few times since we had him. And so we dropped him off at mom's and we just took a ride. And long story short, we saw some lights. They were very strange. We pulled over to the side of the road to look at them. They turned off right in front of us. They were clearly off the ground. I didn't know what it was. We pulled up a little further, pulled off the road. She wanted me to move my son's car seat into the back of the truck so that she could get a better look if we saw something again. Mm-hmm. And so I got out of the truck to put his car seat in the back. I had a cap on the truck, so I opened it up. And as I put the car seat in, as it literally touched the inside of the truck, there was a bright flash to my right. And to the right was where all of the wilderness was, all of the rolling hills of trees and blackness, frankly. And I look over to see a light kind of wavering in the air. It looks like a firework, but going lateral. And I've got this pain in my upper arm, shoulder area, that feels like sucker punched, you know, like really hard. It put me on my knees. It hurt so bad. And I looked over. As I looked over, I thought, I'm going to see somebody swinging something at me. But instead, I see this light. And it winks out right over top of the trees. There's a tree line, I don't know, some several yards off the road. There's a lot of field between me and the trees. And it's right by a CMP telephone switching station. Or, you know, where there's trucks parked and there's a fenced area where they park the trucks. And so there's a little garden set right beside this parking lot. And I'm beside the road. And I look over and I see Lisa and she rolls down the window. She says, "We need to go." I said, "Did you see that?" And she said, "Yeah, we need to go now." And I said, "Well, wait a minute, because did you see where it winked out over there?" And she said, "Yeah." And I said, "Well, it's just to the left here. And do you not see something right there, like right above the trees? There's something there." And we went back and forth a couple times. And she's like, "You need to go. We need to go." And I said, "Well, just give me a second." And I walked right to the back corner of the little garden that was beside this parking lot. And it was tilled up land. I don't know what was planted there, but I walked about halfway up and I kind of knelt down and I'm looking at a dim ring of really tiny, fine red lights. They're very small and they're barely there. And the way I described them was it was hard to look directly at them because you couldn't see them as well as if you looked just to the left or right. And I found out later on that this is a problem that astronomers have when they're viewing very dim stars. If they look to the just the left or right, they become somewhat more visible in the kind of the side periphery vision picks up these things better. Yeah. Apparently, this is something that astronomers deal with all the time. So I'm looking at this thing as best I can. And I know what it looks like. And the thought did occur to me, you know, maybe you shouldn't be sitting here. Maybe you should get in the truck and go home because it's enough already. But I'm going, well, I don't think that's what that is. I'm not sure what that is. And it's not moving and it's nothing dramatic. And I said, well, I'm just going to, and Lisa, of course, is like, we need to go. I'm like, just hold on a minute. So I get up and I say, I'm going to walk just to the corner, the front or the back corner of this tilled up land, which would be towards the hedgerow a little bit more. So as I get up, I'm not taking my eyes off of it. I go to stand up and it turns on. And again, this is, I've said this so many times, it was not like a Close Encounters moment. It wasn't like, oh, here's the big flying saucer. That was not it. It just went from being dim to very clearly visible.
Right.
Not blinding, not any of that nonsense. It just was there. And here it is. It's an oval ring of red lights, evenly spaced, with white lights now unevenly spaced between the red ones. And being the guy that I am, that was my first thought was, besides a list of expletives that I would never utter to anybody and mind-numbing horror, my first thought was, those lights aren't spaced evenly on that thing. Like, that's really like, why is that white one so close to that red one and they're all off? Like, what is that? Like, and that was my first thought. Well, what is that? And then I realized what this is. And literally the first, I mean, that was a reactive thought with the lights, but my first cognitive thought was, this is how I die. Like, this is it. I'm dying. I'm dying. This is it. I'm over. You know, they used to say, well, fear radiates from your chest outward. Well, I'm here to tell you that kind of horror, radiated from my feet up. My feet wouldn't work, and it wouldn't work because I was paralyzed. It wouldn't work because, again, fear is such a trite word. Just absolutely blown away with the most mind-numbing horror that I could possibly even try to describe. And later years, I would say, was that really the reaction that I should have had? Like, what? I mean, but you don't know what it is. You don't know what it's doing. And now it clearly sees you because my standing up made it do that. So it clearly knows I'm looking at it. Ugh. Right. So I'm standing there and it starts to approach. And I look over at Lisa and I really can't hear much of what she's saying. I can only see her going, let's go. We come on, run, do something. And I was just, I just looked back up at it. And at this point, some lights began to get brighter. I looked over at the truck again and I could see light going across the truck and going into the trees. Like, and it still makes me just a little bit queasy to see like a flashlight shown on tree limbs at night. Like, I just, that's not a diggable image for me. Because of that. And that's really all that I remember until I am, I mean, I, there's a disconnect here that I don't remember. That was the last thing I remember seeing, was Lisa not screaming anymore, but just kind of like facing forward. And I was like, okay, freaking out because all of this is going on and it's real and it's really happening. And this is the kind of crap you only see on TV. And now here I am and I'm going to die from this. Like, this is it. And I don't get to say goodbye to anybody. Like, all this stuff is flooding through your head. And, the next thing I know, I am extremely cold. I'm on my back. The surface is hard. Something smells, I don't know, sterile. It's a very, like, it's not a clean smell. It's not a dirty smell. It's just, there's a smell like kind of wet cardboard with some alcohol maybe, or something like that. Like a very strange odor, but it smelled very sterile, very clean. And there was clearly someone to my right, although I was not looking. I could hear them moving around. And I was sobbing uncontrollably, screaming, like a girl, because I remember what I sounded like, and I sounded like a girl. high-pitched wailing. And the thing to my right, or the person to my right, or whatever it was, is saying, open your eye. And I'm saying, no, you know, F you, whatever. I can't even make coherent sentences. And I feel something brushing my eyelash, and it's getting perturbed at this point. It's saying, open your eye, with more force, more anger. And there's a sense of urgency going on. Like there's a, like we're under a time crunch or something.
Mm-hmm.
I just got that sense. Nobody said that. It just, you get this feeling like there's an urgent need to move here. And then something approached up towards my head. And then I, all of a sudden I realized this voice is not audible. I'm hearing this like between my ears. It's coming from inside my head, which disturbed me greatly, and made everything all the more worse. And then something came up towards my head and asked me, was I scared? And I said, yes, I want to go home. I want out of here. I want out. And I literally, like, the thought occurred to me, I think I must be dead now. This is what it is. I'm dead. And this thing said, do you want to hold my hand? And I said, yes. I mean, because at that point you're reaching out for anything.
Right.
And, I opened my hand and it took my hand. And it wrapped all the way around my hand to my palm again. And at that point, I felt like a complete release, like sinking into a warm bath. Like, that's it. That's it. And there I go. And the next thing I know, I'm getting in the truck. And I look at Lisa, and it's really hot in the truck. And I'm like, man, it's hot in here. She said, yeah. And I started the truck, which is odd because I never turned the truck off when I got out. So I start the truck, and it says 11:30. And I must have got out of the truck about 9:30. And I said, it's 11:30? And she goes, how did that happen? I said, I don't know. And, you know, I've often said, if you know me and my wife, we are, we talk to each other like there's a room full of people. Like, that's just what we are. We communicate with each other all the time, over everything. And we drove home in complete silence. And when we got home, we picked the kid up, we got home, we put him to bed. I was in bed and I felt like I wanted to cry. I just felt really upset. And my wife was in the bathroom and I heard her shut the medicine cabinet from brushing her teeth. And I heard her crying. And when I heard her crying, it all came to me. Like, I knew everything that I just described to you. I remembered the sighting, but I didn't remember how it ended, but I knew something happened, but I didn't know what happened. until I heard her crying. When she cried, I knew. And when she came in, she says, do you know? And I said, I know. And I told her what happened. She said, and she's reading it back to me as I'm saying it to her. So we're confirming each other. And we don't know what each other is thinking. I'm saying, do you remember? And she's like, yes. And you did this. And I said, yes. And you did this. Well, she remembered, at some point I was there and there was a light and then I wasn't there. And she said, she was facing the front of the truck and she saw somebody in the truck with her and it was large. And, she saw an eye, a large eye, squint. She said it was very dark, but she couldn't say it was the classic black eye thing. But it was dark, and it squinted, and she felt like she was floating. And at that point, she said everything went pink. And we kind of surmised that everything went pink because she closed her eyes, and the light flooded through her eyelids. That's the best explanation we can come up with. But then she said instantly, it was seamless, that I was getting in the truck and it was really hot and stuffy in the truck. And that was it. So we don't know. She does not want to. She cannot talk about that without falling apart, even to this day. Like, literally, if she tries to tell that story to somebody, she completely falls apart. And, you know, and that was literally it for me. Like, I'm like, okay, I get it. Like, I don't need any more. I understand. I get it. So now what? And off we go, as we say. And there's been a lot more since then with other people. And, you know, and it's like I said, we don't have a lot of friends. We just don't.
And how old were you when that happened to you, roughly?
I'm going to say around 23 or 24, maybe.
Okay. So we had
my son, like, we got married and 6 months later she was pregnant. So my son was born. So I was probably, I lie. I was probably 25, 26, maybe somewhere in there, because I think I was 23 or 4 when I got married. So maybe a year or so after that. So yeah, I mean, he wasn't one yet. So he was still a real little baby. And that was it. I mean, I, at that point, met one of my closest friends of all time, which was the guy that I was told to contact by a friend of mine in the sign business. We talked and he said, well, what do you remember? And I told him, and he was, okay, I want you to do something. And I said, okay. He says, I want you to sit down with this pad and I want you to really think over the next few days about all the weird things that you just told me, write them down. But also remember everything in your life that you kind of like struck you odd, but you couldn't figure out. And you start seeing these things pop up. But the first words that he said to me, and his name was Lee, he said, how many UFOs have you seen in your life? And I said, oh, like 6. And he's like, you know, most people don't see one, right? And I was like, huh, is that right? And he's like, yeah. He's like, you know, I've seen a lot too. And I was like, okay. And then you realize, you connect the dots and you go, okay, well, this is the reason for the Ohio thing. Like, that was probably some manifestation of this. That, you know, the nighttime, the early things from 5 to 9, this is what this was clearly that, but there was no ship. It's as Whitley Strieber says in the movie, this happened in a house, you know?
Yeah.
Why do you connect this with spacemen? Like, no, you don't. You know, but I've been through all the, you know, like, I don't mean to trivialize that for people, because everybody goes through that thinking it's extraterrestrials and they're here to study us and you shouldn't be afraid and it should be an interesting experience. You should be intrigued by this. I was never intrigued by this. You know, all I could say was, why me? Haven't I got enough? You know, I got enough. I got a kid to raise. And then it began to interact with him as a baby. and which quite
as a baby
with him as a baby. Yes.
How did he interact with him?
Only the one story that I can tell you was I was in the living room, and again, this bugger's belief for anybody with a child, especially a little baby. I was in my chair watching TV. Lisa had gone to bed already, and I heard my son Cody. I heard him kind of cooing and talking and, you know, yammering as they do. And so I thought, well, maybe he needs to eat something. Maybe he's thirsty. Maybe I should just sit and rock him for a while. Cause I couldn't wait to have a kid. Like, I love kids, and he is still my life, even at 23 years old. You know, but I was just so like this little sweet little baby of mine, you know? And so I got up to go in his room to pick him up and bring him out. And, in the dark, there was clearly something in his room. There was light coming in from the window. I could clearly see something large headed, leaning over the bed. And I don't know how else to explain. The communication was not, I didn't hear it in my head. I didn't hear it with my ears, but I got this sense of, I've kind of described it as a mad dog growling at you but not moving on you. But kind of a kind of, if you had to put it in a humanistic term, if you had to put some kind of anthropomorphic wedge on it and say it was through gnashed teeth, a go out and sit down. You know, through gnashed teeth, through closed teeth, like Nasty said. And I said, well, yeah, I'll do that. And I went out and I sat in my chair, and that was that. And in a couple minutes, he stopped talking, and I went in, and there he was, sound asleep, fit as a fiddle, nothing wrong, nothing disturbed. But he never cried of that. He never anything. But when I told my wife that, she was livid. And I said, you need to understand, there's nothing I could do. I mean, there is nothing. And this is one thing that I learned that made it easier for me, is that there is nothing you can do in that situation. Yeah. It's there. It's whatever it is manifested there. And it clearly doesn't want you around. And one of the things that I've always gotten from this phenomena, and I'm not sure if your experiences, kind of say this to you, whenever I've been in the presence of whatever they are, if it's even a they, I get the sense of extreme age, like ancient.
Oh yeah.
What is that? I don't know what that is, but in my head, I always think of elder people are the smart ones. They know, they can tell me what to do and I have to do it. That's just, you know, the certain way you're raised, you listen to your elders. Well, this is like the ultimate elder to me. You know, it's like, go sit down. Everything's fine. Go sit down. But it's said in a way that's very authoritative. And there's not the option to say no. This is what people don't get. Like a normal dad, they would say, would rush in there and beat the crap out of this thing for being near your newborn baby.
Sure.
You don't have that option. People don't get that it does something to you that doesn't allow you to act on those kind of feelings. You're not in that kind of space in that experience. You cannot react that way. It's not in you to react that way. Here's the other thing you hear. Well, if you saw the UFO for, I don't know, a minute, why didn't you get a camera? Because that's not in you to do that. That's not what's important to you in that moment. Your importance is keep your eyes on it. What's it going to do now? You know, but people without the experience, they don't understand that. And that's a very hard thing to try and explain to somebody, why you don't act to make an effort to gather, because proof is the last thing on your mind. Well, it's right there. Proof of anything. You know,
we've also found in some of our roundtable discussions that a lot of times, you know, people have an experience it's a really weird experience. It should freak them out. And then they go to bed.
Oh, absolutely.
And it's like, well, that just seems odd. You know, it's like you should be all freaked out and not able to sleep. And instead you're just like, oh, okay.
Well, I was not able to sleep. Like Lisa and I had something fairly recently, as far as history goes, of a thing in the bedroom with us that clearly had a big head. We had not seen anything like this in ages. And never had we seen, and again, tell me if this feels familiar to you. You sense this about this thing. That when you're in the presence of this thing, that there is clearly some kind of altered state going on.
Oh yeah.
But it's not high. It's not, it's just something else. There's a different feeling to reality that is almost more real than real. In mm-hmm. other words, things that seem inanimate, like a chair, become not something more than what they are, not anything so dramatic as that, but just everything seems to have a buzz to it when this thing is in the presence of. There's just something about the air is different. I believe, whatever it is, it brings something of its place to here. And I think that might be what that is. That's just a guess, purely speculation.
Well, you get that term more real than real, too, from people who have had things like near-death experiences.
Yes, yes, yes.
So it may be that altered state that we're picking up on that's more real of reality, like, than what we're experiencing normally.
Right, right. And I'm sure part of that is also the stressful shock of seeing something that you don't understand. I get that. That's probably part of it, too. But, you know, but this experience that Lisa and I had, we didn't talk about it. Like, I woke up in the middle of the night and there it is. It's standing there. But I can't make up my mind what I'm looking at. Now, the guy talking to your audience right now, I would immediately know what that was if I turned around right now and saw it. I would run like hell, right? I get it. In this mindset, when I wake up out of a dead sleep and I'm staring wide awake, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed at something standing there. I get up on my elbow. It leans away from me. I said, did that just move or what is that? Like, that must be something on the desk that's catching the light in just the right way. No, moron. Something is standing there with a very large round head. Okay. What do? Flop back down and go to sleep. I'll figure it out in the morning.
Yeah.
Are you serious? I don't say anything to my wife. 2 days later, I believe it was 2 days or a day or so later, a friend comes over for a visit, and he's saying, anything weird happened in the house lately? Because he knows the history of what we've seen here. He's seen some of it himself. Anything weird going on? And I said, well, nothing in this room. I said, but I don't think I want to tell Lisa what I saw in the bedroom the other night. And she looks at me and she goes, I already know. Thing standing beside the bed with the big head. And I'm like, are you serious? You did not just say that. Well, that made it all too real for me, because I had thought the whole next day, like, what was that? There was nothing on the desk to make that shape. What was that? And I know what it looked like, but is that what it was? Well, she woke up, saw it, and then squinted her eyes, rubbed her eyes, didn't see it, rubbed her eyes again, saw it again. It was intermittent for her. And but she did see it. She said, yeah, it had very thin shoulders, very large head, like a little bigger than a basketball, very thin shoulders. And it was just standing there staring at you. And I'm like, what was it doing besides that? She goes, I don't know. I woke up when you flopped down. So that was how that transpired. I didn't sleep for a week, dude. I didn't sleep. I went to bed at 5:30 a.m. every morning. You know, I slept for like 4 hours until 9, you know, I mean, brutal. And I finally, you know, I talked to some people that basically just said to me, you know, it's a pass through. There's a little bit more to that story that makes it completely implausible and paints me in a really ridiculous light, which is that we had a rather large quartz crystal out in the lawn that had been there for 6 years or so. 4 years at the time, probably. And I put it to my forehead, just playing around. I did nothing else different that would ensue, that would essentially be anything different than what I had done any other weekend. It's a completely normal weekend. That was the only thing I had done. And when I mentioned this to a couple researchers that I know, they go, "What are you, crazy?" I'm like, "What do you mean? I don't believe in crystal nonsense. I don't buy it." And right. They said, "Well, regardless of whether you buy it or not, it is a method of, you know, like scientists and electronics people, they use this to store energy. Crystals store energy. That's all you need to know. You don't have to believe any of the other crap. But just know there is something to that. And if you had one outside for that long a time, you don't know what's been done to it or had what it's collected." I said, "I don't know that it's a rock, dude. Like, seriously." "Well, I got news for you. That's the only thing that I did. And everybody tells me that's why that thing showed up." I'm like, "Well, that completely marginalizes the entire event to me, which is perfect in the grand scheme of things."
Right, right.
Right? Because I don't believe in crystal crap. Like, I don't buy it. I'm sorry, I just don't. Magic rocks? Really? No. Well, I now know there is something to that. Now, here's the problem. And as I said to Jeremy on one of our last programs, is that the phenomena trying to marginalize itself, through me trying to marginalize the event by saying, "The guy believes in crystals. What are you kidding me?" Right? Or is there really something to a quartz crystal left outside for 6 years in the elements, the snow, the rain, the wind, everything? I don't know. I don't know what to think of that. I know what I saw. And here's the caveat to that vision of seeing this thing standing there in the room. I was not in that altered feeling of reality. There was no – it was like it was standing there like I'm standing here. There was no weirdness surrounding this. It didn't communicate anything to me. It just stood there and stared at me. That was really unsettling, in that there was no – the only buffer was go to sleep. Figure it out in the morning. You know? That doesn't make any sense. You know? And people have asked me – the questions you get when you describe something like this is, well, how to get in the house? Well, that's the last thing you're concerned about, how to get in the house. I don't know. You know, I don't. Maybe the dogs let it in. I don't know. I mean, you know, these are the questions people ask you. Like, the question is, what was it doing there? You know, that was a mind blower for me and a game changer. Because I got to think, if I did that again, I'd see it again.
Have you tried?
No. Are you kidding me? I like sleep. No? No.
I would totally try it.
Well, a friend of mine over in the UK wants me desperately to send it to him. Here's my problem. I have to touch it to send it to him, and I'm not touching. I'm sorry. I am a grown 50-year-old man afraid of a rock. See, this is what it does to you people. You know, you don't get it. This is what it does. You know? I mean, I don't know what to say about that experience. Although, I tell you, that was one of the more viscerally real. I mean, it doesn't sound like much in the grand scheme of other things that I've experienced, but that was like being at work and having them walk into work and say, "Hey, we're here." What? I mean, it was so in your face. I was not sleepy. I wasn't paralyzed with fear. I wasn't anything. I just kind of looked and went, "What is that?" And knew perfectly well what it is. Makes no sense. But there it was. And it was very much solid and very much there. I do take some solace in that when I leaned towards it, it leaned away from me. Right. That's interesting, right? I mean, that's a good takeaway. So what's that mean? I don't know. I guess we'll find out one day, but that whole experience was, I thought, am I back on the, you know, am I back to being the scared guy all the time, afraid to take the trash out at night? Is that coming again? Because I don't want that. And so, you know, you tell yourself what you have to make yourself go to sleep again. And I don't know what more to say about it than that. It was incredibly visceral to me.
All right, and that is where we're going to stop with part two of this conversation with Jeff Ritzman. There's another good hour plus to go in his experiences and such. So, again, if you want to hear the whole thing in one piece right now, you can become a patron at wheredidtheroadgo.com. $3 a month gets you any pre-recorded interviews like this. You'll get the whole thing all at once. You won't have to wait for the separate parts. And I'm going to have quite a few multi-part interviews coming up over the summer, I believe. Also, there'll be an extra bit with Jeff where we were talking about ghost hunting shows and stuff like that. All right, to take you out off Mechanism's first EP, this is Bring Back the Sun. See you next week.
だから一人で寂しい